Aloha, friends. I'm Matthew Gray. Welcome to 50 Tastes of Gray. Today, Laura Souter, a strategic brand consultant, joins me. She's at the dynamic intersection of design and business. For me, this is a particularly fascinating topic, as Laura has been able to combine her potent fusion of strategy in the world of art and design. That's quite the bridge, wouldn't you say? In our conversation today with Laura, we delve into her deep commitment to serving artistic clients across various fields, including healthcare, finance, and law. Join us as she shares her wealth of knowledge and experiences, offering insights into the delicate balance between creativity and business. Get ready for a captivating conversation on 50 Tastes of Gray with the brilliant Laura Souter. If you enjoy the show, like, subscribe, comment, and sign up for my newsletter at lovelife.com. Laura, I'm so glad that you've joined me today on 50 Tastes of Gray. Thank you so much for coming on in.
I'm so glad to be here. I'm glad to meet you. And you sound like a fun guy, so I can't wait to just connect.
Are you enjoying your summertime so far?
I am. I cannot complain. I just got back from 3 weeks in Italy. My summer has definitely kicked off with a bang, and I still have more good summer to enjoy. So I'm a happy girl.
Oh, good for you. Good for you. Yeah. Well, you know, I start off each and every one of these shows by asking my guests, what have you eaten today?
That's a funny question. Today, I actually had leftover Dutch baby from the weekend. We made a cast iron Dutch baby. I don't know if you had it. And I used a different recipe and my family did not like it. So therefore, I got leftovers this morning. And that is all I've had. And some leftover potatoes.
You must tell everybody what a Dutch baby is.
It's relatively simple. Eggs, flour, some nutmeg, and some cheese in this one. And you make it in a cast iron skillet. So it's sort of like frittata-y, like a little bit like a frittata. And then because it has, and a little pinch of sugar and salt, and because it's less eggy and more floury, it kind of blows up a little bit. Pretty. It's a very nice brunch type of thing.
Oh, it sounds kind of like a puffy pancake.
It was like a puffy, eggy pancake. And you can do lots of fun things with it, with like camembert and different cheeses. This one was relatively simple and a little nutmeg forward, which did not go over with my family. So therefore, I got it.
Did you grate your own nutmeg or did you use the powdered stuff?
Uh-huh. No, I did. My cousin and his wife went to Africa and they picked nutmeg from, I guess, a nutmeg tree. And I got as a little gift, a little baggie of nutmeg nuts, and I actually grated it myself.
A little bit of trivia. Did you know that the coating around a nutmeg is what mace is?
Gosh, no, I did not know that.
Yeah. So that one nutmeg actually gives us both mace and the nutmeg itself.
Oh my gosh. I wonder how that part of the stuff I'm grating, or is that something that contains the thing I'm grating?
It's separate. It's sort of like the leaf that surrounds or the coating that surrounds a nutmeg before they're separated.
I see. Okay.
Random food trivia.
Yeah. Well, I did not know that.
Since you were just in Italy, and we're on the topic of food, tell us a little bit about some of the delicious food experiences you had while there.
Oh, gosh. I could talk for an hour just about food. So, of course, the pasta was incredible. And I am not the hugest pasta eater just because of, like, the carbs, etc. However, I indulged myself to perfection. And it was worth every calorie or every carb or whatever. And additionally, we went to a cooking class and learned how to make our own ravioli. And we made also these like Italian eggplant rollatinis and our own tiramisu. And we drank wine that they had made. Of all the meals that we had, I think that one was the most special because we made it. The ingredients were top-notch, fresh, and amazing. And we had that like camaraderie with our fellow students. It was just a fun half day of eating and drinking and relaxing.
Oh, yeah. When everyone is a little bit tipsy, you're having the whole social lubricant thing going on in the kitchen. That's good.
Yeah, it was super fun. We made our own mozzarella, too, which is super easy. And I want to learn how to do that.
Is that something you might take on at home?
I think so. I mean, again, at home, I try to be a healthy eater and try not to have too much cheese or bread or all that stuff. But oh my God, fresh mozzarella, fresh bread, fresh everything. Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
How did you get along with the Italian people? Did they seem like a real nice, friendly culture?
We tried to not be super duper touristy, but we were certainly doing like the tours and things like to the Colosseum and everything. We kind of got that like false niceness that of people catering to, you know, people who are paying money.
Right.
But absolutely, you know, when I had side conversations with people in restaurants or, you know, drivers or whatnot, people were very nice. I speak Italian. I think that helps.
Oh, yeah. Anytime you can speak the language, they love it that much more.
Yeah. I do like to speak Italian and try, even though my Italian isn't very good anymore. I learned it 30 years ago. I still know it enough that I want to practice it. So I was always like, talk to me in Italian.
Do you speak any other languages as well?
French was my native tongue. My mom was a French teacher. And she raised me with French au pairs. So French was our household language until I went to preschool. And then I thought it was weird to talk French. So I kind of rebelled for a little while. And then in third grade, started French in school.
Well, look at you, polyglot all the way.
I love languages. You know, even something simple like going to the nail salon or something like, how do you say thank you? How do you say, you know, just something simple just to connect.
Wow. Laura, I would like you to tell us a little bit about your experience and what you're doing in your career right now.
I'm really in a great place in that I am entering kind of that guru status. Some people might call it like old people status, but I call it my guru status of I have been around the block in the agencies. I've worked on the client side. I've had my own business. I've been on boards, and now I really feel like I have some of that gray-haired established ownership of Pnor, what it is to be, in my world, a provider of strategy and design, and how to really support others to excel. You know, a little bit of more in the mentorship category, teaching. I've done volunteerism for years now, but I think that as of May, my children are off to their pursuits. It's really my time. It's my turn. I get to own that, like, I've been here for a while. I feel legitimate, finally.
You know, it's funny. The word guru definitely takes the sting out of the word old.
Yeah.
You know?
I saw a post today from a 66-year-old woman who I had done a, we had a coach who was training us and help speaking engagements. And she has a really interesting niche that's more in the preparing for funerals, helping people to prepare for taking care of affairs once someone in their lives passes. And long story short, she was treating her differently now that she's in her 60s, like it's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like this is, we, and I'm not in my 60s, but are the people who actually know things.
That's
you
right.
know, and it's important to own that knowledge and to be respected. I was sad to hear that she felt that way.
Yeah, you know, older people are kind of a repository of information because we've learned the history, we've grown through the history, we've experienced that as well. So I think we're more precious as we age older.
Yeah, it's interesting to on that other side where your doctors are, you know, in their 20s. You know, or like they haven't had their children yet, but they're your gynecologist. It's like, what's happening right now?
I know. Isn't that a trip when you go through life and almost everyone is older than you and then you grow a little bit older and everyone is about the same age? And then, like you said, the people who are your doctors and these professionals are half your age.
Exactly.
That's strange. It's a weird feeling, isn't it?
It is weird. I think I always looked younger than my age for a long time. And that bothered me. And I always wanted to be affected and older. And then, you know, so I struggled with imposter syndrome or all of that legitimacy stuff in my 20s and 30s. And then now that I get to like be in my 50s, it's like, oh yeah, I'm owning this. You know, I've arrived.
Would it be correct to call you a strategic brand consultant at this stage of your life?
Yes. My background is design. I went to art school. My differentiator when I started my business 22 years ago was the strategy. Interestingly, again, coming from the art background where art was the thing, I hung my hat on the art. And I always said art is a, or design is art, but it's also a business. And I never really understood the power that I had in those early years of using the strategy. And I didn't charge for it. I assumed that anything I would do for someone would be strategic. And I would do all this research and all this preparation and all these questions and all of this thoughtfulness. And I was just giving it away. And then somewhere along the line, something clicked. And I was like, I'm a brand strategist who does design. Uh-huh. You know, the design is the, you know, is the wrapping of this beautiful present that's in the box. I totally flipped the script for myself. And I think, first of all, I think my clients respected me more meaningful, because people were really buying the strategy and getting the design too, but they were buying the strategy and really needing it to move their businesses forward.
Would you say that your typical client is an artistic person who's trying to bridge the gap between the art and creative over to the business world, which they have no idea about?
I have a real interest in serving clients who have an artistic eye, like architects, interior designers, landscape architects, anybody who is a lighting designer or creates things for the home. I just love working with people who are aesthetic in nature. But I also have a real healthy part of my business that is for healthcare or financial services or law, things that are more heady and not so design related. But I do have a sweet spot for clients who already are aesthetic. You know, they themselves are artists in their own.
That's really interesting to me, because I'm just wondering about your typical client would come to you because they want to improve their status or the perception of the marketplace, or they're looking to build their business, or they're looking to get a little of a different kind of attitude, or how exactly would you deal with, let's say, someone in healthcare or someone in any specific area?
Most of my branding clients are going through some sort of transition. So obviously launching is a big transition. They're starting from scratch and they don't have anything. But then there are also the clients who are succession planning. They've been, you know, they're 65. They want to leave their brand in good hands to grow and prosper and create a legacy for themselves. Those clients are taking something that maybe they have, whatever, 12 staff people and make a couple million dollars a year, but they really want to, this is their baby. They want to prepare it for the next generation and up-level it. So I will do renaming, take their current niche, which might be kind of basic or regional, and say, hey, you can crack, you know, with new eyes and new leadership, you can crack open the space and go either national or global or whatever the situation is. Maybe you can convert clients from kitchen and baths into whole house remodels. Just help them look at things bigger. And people get a little braver when those transitions are happening, either a change in leadership or, like I said, succession planning. Somebody's growing up into the ranks, or maybe they want to sell the business. I do a huge amount of competitive analysis where I'm looking at who's close by, who's doing the same thing, who's nearby and might be coming in to do the same thing or poised to do the same thing. And how can we do it just a little bit more in a different way, or what's called niching down? So, for example, don't just be a parent coach, be a step parent coach to bio moms, or to moms who already have their own bio kids, or be a step parent coach to moms who don't have their own kids. You know, mm-hmm. Be as specific as possible. And even though it seems like you're closing the door to a lot of business, we know that it becomes a funnel as opposed to a closure. It's a funnel.
So even with that kind of like narrow casting attitude, you think it does drill down and specify the marketplace that person wants to serve?
Typically, yes. Uh-huh. With messaging and consistency, yes. And if people don't lose sight of the prize, they get scared and only do it for a few weeks and then pull back or start to do something and then change direction, or be like, oh, well, I want to do bio moms and dads of bio, you know, bio kids, or I want to do this and that, it ends up getting a little muddied.
Right. You know, in the last number of years, this is interesting because I've been speaking about this and thinking about this a lot with the increase of this kind of communication from thousands of miles away electronically. And yet there are people out there who are independents who are trying to niche themselves into a certain area. Is there some sort of a competitive aspect of the marketplace that's hurting the small mom and pop, the independent operator, when there's so many big corporations out there who are trying to serve the marketplace in every possible way?
Absolutely. I think it is very difficult. As an example, one of my favorite coffee shops, I was in there yesterday and I said, how many locations do you have now? I think they used to have 4 or 5 in Boston, and they're back to their one original place, which is near my house. I was so sad because the product is so good. They roast their own coffee. They are so passionate. They literally go to wherever, Australia or wherever, to buy the beans and get the beans, and they know the farmers. And I lovingly will pay the whatever, $7 to get this amazing cup of coffee. It's a huge treat, but it is only one. And right. when that set of owners gets tired of struggling, they're going to give up. My favorite health food store, I drove by that street recently. They're closed. I love that store. I alone can't support the store. I obviously hadn't been there in a long time. I'm also guilty of not doing the do. But it's so sad that, yes, Whole Foods has taken over all of the health food stores, all of them.
Right, right. And they bring it to you.
And then they bring it to you with the Amazon truck.
Right,
so
right.
It is happening all the time. Restaurants, dry cleaners. The franchise model is definitely scraping clean. It's like the forest being deforested. You know, all of those mom and pop dry cleaners, gone.
It's complicated and confusing in this day and age because everyone has heard the term mergers and acquisitions. And it just sounds like a businessy term if you don't think about it. But really what it is the big companies, big corporations coming in and opening up shop right next door to your coffee shop and then purchasing you and putting you out of business, or just outdoing you because they're selling it your $7 cup of coffee for $5.
Yeah.
And it's a strange marketplace right now. So how do you motivate your clients to be able to get through this? Because this is tough stuff. That's an extra level of competition.
This is sort of where that mentorship and modeling comes in. It's about mindfulness and really making sure that you as a business owner have all your screws tightened, all the hatches battened down. You yourself are doing the best work you can on your own mindset and working on yourself so that you don't lose faith and hope for yourself. Because if you waver, your customers will waver. If you don't come out strong and you don't have the fortitude and the self, the faith in self, then your employees aren't going to follow you. They're going to waver and they're going to leave and they're going to jump ship. So mindfulness is actually very important. Mindset and mindfulness for the business owner.
Something that would help someone build a more powerful identity for their brand?
I think so. I think sometimes when a client comes to me and they themselves can't articulate it, I'll send them either to a business coach or they'll see me for a period of sessions to become more clear, because what I provide clients is sometimes uncomfortable. You have no idea how emotional it is to rebrand a company. It is very emotional. I've had CEOs of a bank cry in a boardroom about, wow, we had the same logo from the 1970s and now this is our new logo. I can't believe it. It's too much for them sometimes. I've had other CEOs slam their fist down on conference tables and be like, I'm not gonna get rid of my effing eagle. I want my effing eagle. You know, and the other company has a boat and they have an eagle. Well, can the eagle ride on the boat? Like, what can we do here? I want my eagle. They get very territorial with mergers, and everybody wants either their color or their expression from their logo represented in the new mark. It gets very testy. Corporate leaders, the business owners, really need to feel confident about what it is, where they want to go, and that they can achieve it. Maybe not this year, but in 5 to 10 years, they can.
How do you deal with the person who has been running a business and has been fairly successful for X number of years, but doesn't have delegation skills and they don't have technical skills. And the world is moving into a different place to where now you need to either understand marketing, have social marketing, or have some sort of technical skills to be able to join all the forces together to succeed. So what do you do with that person who comes in and doesn't even know how to download a file?
Unfortunately, I'm very familiar with that and it doesn't go very well. I've seen it on a smaller scale with a local East Coast fine home and remodeling builder. I've seen it in a larger company for a non-dairy dairy. It was a family-run business in both cases. The owner of the non-dairy dairy, I say non-dairy dairy because he still thought in his mind like he had a dairy. This is during COVID and he treated it like everyone had to come in and milk cows. He would have his assistant print out every email and fax it to his home. He treated meetings like marathons and not, let's get to the point, what are we doing here? I mean, it is very common, especially in family-run businesses, because nobody wants to push back on dad. Nobody wants to push back on grandpa. And it really is tough and unworkable because everything is online. There's the Google communication suite. There's Dropbox. There's all these methods. And nothing works if you can't move with the times.
Right. We've all met so many educated derelicts who can't really put two and two together, and yet they know what they know. They know surgery or they know a particular aspect of something, but that's not enough in this day and age. You really do need the entire aspect of all these different skill sets to be able to join forces. And it's way different than it used to be in the corporate world.
It's true. I mean, even in the medical field, I had a telehealth appointment yesterday for an Achilles tendon issue. And we're doing so much now. Doctors, lawyers, whoever, they need to know so much. Dentists, you know, it's the technology, it's the non-paper paper trail and records keeping data and obviously marketing and outreach. And anyway, it's a lot for every business owner.
Yeah. You know, when you specify people in the medical world, they're spending more time dealing with their electronic health records than they are spending time with their patients. And I think that's a big,
I agree.
Such an obstacle because, you know, you're in there for, they have a good 5 minutes to spend with you. And then they have like, you know, half an hour of records and computer stuff. And that's why most doctors can't open up their own clinic and they have to work for the man and be in a corporate environment, which they're all miserable about doing.
Exactly.
Yeah. So do you help people overcome those kind of challenges? Or do you just say, be mindful, get over that stuff, do what they tell you, try to be more mindful? I mean, how is it, where's the balance in that scale?
So you talked about delegation. I think in the case with either an older owner or an owner who's stubborn to learn new pathways in terms of technology, et cetera, I might ask to interface with somebody else in their office and then either have that person, you know, train up the other individual, still have that business owner do the decision making, but have a more regular interface with the more technologically savvy partner or employee. Again, it's not always possible. In the case of the fine home builder, that person just decided they didn't care if they had a new website. They didn't care if they were going to move their marketing into the next millennia. They were fine with where things were. And we had a contract. We finished the contract and we moved on. So
sort of each of you went your own ways. I mean, you expressed what you thought would be their best move. They decided against it and then you parted ways. That sounds fair.
Yeah. Sometimes battles aren't won or they don't see the rationale for it and their business is going to go their way. This is a company with a father who's still operational and three sons who are probably mid-50s and they'll do what they'll do. Probably the sons will take it to the next level after dad, you know, is ailed. We just don't know.
You know, you talk about the kids taking over after the father. Give us an example of a memorable marketing campaign that you were able to be at the helm of after the father passed away or the person who developed the business and it was then left to the kids and they're going, we don't know what to do.
I had that with a financial services company based in New Hampshire. Exactly that situation. Father was still living, but an older retired person that wanted to still be around, but not daily. So the son took over and made a lot of changes in terms of going from one location to three with the eye to move regional instead of just in their town of, we really revolutionized the look and feel. We kept the logo, but treated it differently, if it makes sense. So it was a green line drawing logo on white, and I inversed it and made it a fine line on a field of color. It was more contemporary, same similar mark, but done in a more contemporary fashion. And then the look and feel was very bold, hired professional writers, professional photographers to bring it into the current century, if you will.
So having been in the design world for as many years as you have, and within this past year with AI coming into focus, how has that affected your design and your thinking related to design?
I think it's kind of interesting and cool as far as my own is what AI can do, or really anything that's templated like Canva or any of the templated services that are out there. I always think that there's room for quote unquote the real thing. There's always going to be someone that needs template. And I think templates are perfect for many. But if somebody wants something actually unique to them that can grow with them for 10, 20, 30 plus years, that's the type of client that I want. I want the client that is, they want the UPS logo. They want the FedEx logo. They want the thing that is ownable, that can't be templated or can't be generated by necessarily a computer. My logos are extremely simple, and I'm sure they could be created by a computer. On the other hand, I just think that if somebody wants a service versus a provider, they're going to come to me. I'm the provider. I think based on my experience with content AI, you can get lots of good ideas, but you would never, ever use it like the way it is. I got some great itineraries for my trip to Europe, but did I do it that way? No, I got ideas. You know, it's not perfect.
So related to that trip to Europe and the itineraries, where did you get them from? Did you go online and look for itineraries, or did you work with what used to be called a travel agent?
I actually used a travel agent, and I did a lot on my own. I am in a networking group, and she was in my networking group, and I've been listening to her for 5 years talk about this. And I thought, wow, I need to have the trip of a lifetime. I took my two daughters. It was their graduation gift. And I thought, let's just hand off some of this to someone else. And it was wonderful. She got our train tickets. She got our ferry tickets. She got personal drives along the Amalfi Coast. I got the plane tickets myself. I got the Airbnb myself, but she got me two hotels. It was a combination.
Oh, that sounds good. You know, what you're doing is so highly personal, and it's intimate in the kind of context of helping people build a brand and a business. How do you establish the personal connection? Because I think without that, you're effed. How do you create that kind of rapport with someone?
Well, I am a people person. I love people. It's ironic that I work for myself by myself, because I really am a people person. Similarly to how you talk to me, like, let's just talk, let's get to know each other. What brightens your day? What do you want to be when you grow up? Who do you want to be when you grow up? If you could throw all the paper in the air, what would be the one piece of paper that you'd want to catch and put on your wall? Just what does your desk look like? What does your day look like? All these questions that are helping me to determine that little girl or boy aspirational part of them that still wants to hold that balloon at the top of the hillside and roll down the hill and laugh and scream. And what would happen if all of your dreams came true? That is how I talk to them.
Generally,
you know, there's some shyness, like, wow, nobody's really asked me that before. I haven't been asked that since I was a little kid, and auntie whatever asked me that. There's some vulnerability to it. It's especially if it's somebody's own business. They're very vulnerable because they have the imposter syndrome too. They don't know what's possible. They're afraid that if they say it to me or to anyone, they'll look foolish. Or what if it doesn't come true? What if they tell their staff and it doesn't happen? Will the staff leave? It's emotional.
So do you think that most of the people that you're seeing are optimistic or pessimistic? And in what ways can you integrate a strategy that you know is right to be able to build a business, and yet they're in their childlike mind?
Some people come to me out of fear because they fear the competition's getting too close, or let's just say it's COVID and things need to rush into virtual land that hasn't been. Maybe they were slow to have a balance of physical and digital. So sometimes people are scared and reactive. Sometimes they are excited, like especially the people who are launching. Everything's possible. Sky's the limit. Let's do it. Go big or stay home. You know, there's that mentality.
Right.
And then there's also the people who are kind of been there, done that. Oh, I've tried everything. Nothing's going to work. I can't imagine that you have a magic pill for that, you know, or whatever. I've seen all of that.
Do you have to stay updated with the newest and latest trends, or is it really kind of like old fashioned, roll up your sleeves, let's put this in an ordered fashion and make it happen?
I've never been a trendy designer. I've really been more of a classicist. I got my start at House Beautiful Magazine and Town and Country Magazine. Each of them celebrated 100 and 150 years when I was with each of those magazines. So I come from like an old school grid, classic, Paul Rand type of education. I will never be the trendiest designer out there. I like to build things that last and have relevance. I was a professor for 11 years and I've seen all of the trends come and go. Nothing's wrong with having a trendy logo, but typically we go for timeless. That's the frame of mind for us.
Can you teach timeless?
I think I can in terms of simplicity. I used to tell my students that, like, just think of a diamond. You know, you have hundreds of pounds of debris and dust and dirt and stuff that gets compressed into one little tiny gem, so small you can almost barely see it. It is perfection. So that is what I go for, is simple, timeless, easy to understand. And that's it.
With that response, I'm thinking that whatever museums you went to while in Europe, you probably go for the old world stuff more so than any of the modern stuff.
Truthfully, I love modern art. I didn't go to any modern art in Italy. I was in the Vatican and in the Colosseum, you know, the Pompeii Museum. I love modern art. I love especially simple modern art, the very classic stuff. I think when I say classic, it's funny because in the art world, classic can be very ornate and very fancy and extra. And the modern art world is typically less is more often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you talk about branding strategies, and since you were just in Italy, how would you say the Vatican has pulled off their branding strategies?
I did not realize that the Vatican used marble and art that was stolen. So most of the marble, most of the art was borrowed from other areas and cultures. Some were obviously gifts to the Vatican, but the Colosseum, as an example, a lot of the marble from the Colosseum was taken for the building the Vatican. I don't know. I'm a little confused I loved it. I loved seeing it. I loved seeing the artwork. I loved seeing every, you know, part of the gardens and the rooms and the maps. But I also was a little disturbed by the history of the evolution of and of the creation of the Vatican.
You know, so much of these truths are coming to light now. And,
right.
You know, whether, you know, we're colonialists or we're utilizing things that were pilfered or taken in conflicts and things like that, it's just like, oh my gosh, what are we to believe? Where do we just say enough's enough? Or do we just continue to uncover this?
I was fascinated by it. And I also didn't necessarily know all of the story of how it was created until the tour. And then later I went to the Colosseum and learned more. They were like, all of these, you know, missing blocks of marble and all the metal that would have foundations, those were all taken and moved to the Vatican. And, you know, I just kept hearing that all throughout the Italy trip. Oh, that would have been here, but it was moved to the Vatican. That would have been here, it was moved to the Vatican. Anyway, I know that the world is a complicated place.
I wonder who the person is who's going to write the Dear Pope letter. Please return this to the Middle East.
I don't know. I just, you know, I think so much of our best monuments and the pyramids and the horrible slave labor that went into creation of all these beautiful monuments and places of worship and things. Head around.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm wondering how you would measure the success of a client who you've worked with. Would it be the personal success? Would it be how their business responded to your hard work? Does it have to do with some sort of a blend of the two? Or how exactly do you measure your success?
That's a great question. I've actually measured it differently over the years and throughout the years and with different clients. An example could be, I know I did such great work, and after 9 months of working, their competitor bought them. Mm-hmm. So my work never even showed up. It never went into the world. The employees never got to use it. The marketplace never got to enjoy it. Even though it never, quote unquote, went anywhere, it elevated the corporation to a place that their competitor thought it was attractive enough on the balance sheet, but also from a brand standpoint to pick it up. You know, there's successes like that, which at times feels like a failure. And then there's the job well done in terms of the personality. Honestly, I have to say, you know, it really needs to be, how does it show in the marketplace? You know, mm-hmm. that family-owned business with one location, which was a fairly humble local financial guy, now has 10 locations and multiple, you know, sets of partners and advisors. That's a huge success. You know, it's also a success when a client continues to work with me on retainer, and I know that I'm their trusted advisor for all things brand launch. That also feels like a success when they continue to loop me in, bring me on, whether it's 10 hours a month or a relatively short amount of time. I'm the one who's keeping it all together and helping advise new, you know, let's say they have other marketing associates in their office. I'm the one who's teaching them and coaching them on how to use the system so that everything stays consistent.
As far as metrics go, what's more important, growth or satisfaction?
I think it's both. So for the aesthetic companies, they need to look great. That's very important to them. They can still, let's just say they're a furniture manufacturer. They don't necessarily need to sell more chairs. They're happy with the functionality of stream of manufacturing, but they need to look good. They need to feel polished. They need a look that represents their aesthetic brand. And I think certain types of clients are going to be more growth oriented. Like I had a chemical company reached out to me. They wanted to move into food grade oil, like cooking oil. And they're all about the numbers. They're all about more units, more places. And that's their mindset. So for the brand of this cooking oil to be successful, they're going to look at gallons on the shelves. That's all they're going to look at. So I think there's a little bit of a difference. I think generally bottom line is what people are looking for, but I can tell you with authority that the aesthetic clients of mine, they need to look great. The chemical company, I don't think they care what it looks like, truthfully.
Right. They probably don't care about its impact on people's health either.
Not really.
Okay, so if you understand that going into a project and someone is doing something that you just don't jive with for one reason or another, will you say, I'm sorry, I cannot represent you? Or do you just work knowing that, you know, this is business and you can work with them even though you don't agree with them?
So I was approached by that particular company by their purchasing agent. You know, she got a vendor request from blah, blah, blah department for blah, blah, blah design services. So, you know, I know that it's just a numbers game. They probably are going to choose, I put in a proposal, they're going to choose the least amount of money for the proposal probably. Or maybe they even have a provider, but they legally have to put it out to bid to three people. Right. I haven't heard a positive response from them yet. So if I get the project, of course, I will do my best job to create a visual that is the best visual that I feel like they deserve. I feel like it'll be the right solution. I wouldn't turn them down. Would I expect that they will probably be relatively basic? I can still do beautiful work and be basic, if that makes sense.
I see. So, okay. So you would kind of take a look at them more in the design kind of side of your world versus the morality and the ethics of their business. So you wouldn't work with them necessarily on a marketing standpoint, but on a design standpoint, you would?
I think that I've never been approached by somebody whose ethics and morals I'm frightened by or worried by. So luckily, I haven't had to decline anyone for that reason, that I didn't connect with them on that front. But I always said, like, when I was in corporate, and I had a junior designer complain about doing a, let's just say a bookmark. I used to work for Borders Books. I was their creative director. So my junior designer would say, oh, I can't be creative. It's just a bookmark. You can do a lot with a little. Make that the most beautiful bookmark ever been, you know? So this chemical company who's selling food grade oil, why can't that bottle be great? You know, why can't it be great? It'll be simple. It'll be different than something that's on a Whole Foods shelf or on a Target shelf, but it will still be meaningful design.
I see. Would you say that most of your success is related to helping the little guy more so than helping the Borders of the world or the Starbucks of the world?
I've done both. I've had TJ Maxx and Home Goods as clients. I've had Fidelity as a client. I've had Biogen as a client. And then I've also had a 12-person interior design firm as a client. I think part of it for me has been bandwidth. As a single mom, I was a single mom for basically most of my parenting. And in the beginning of my career, I did take on those bigger consulting projects that took 6 to 9 months to complete. Then, you know, as life and kids got busier, I started taking more smaller projects that could be accomplished in a more foreseeable time frame. But now I really like the combination of the small and the large, because the large offers complex brand architecture decisions. So for example, you might have a master company, but they have several different business units or different businesses. What do you do with those? What's the relationship to the parent company? Who gets the credit? Is it the individual brand or is it the parent company that is bringing the brand to life? Those are the complex things that only come with bigger projects, bigger companies. But then the smaller businesses, I get those intimate relationships.
Right.
And that's
right.
Really fun too.
Yeah, probably the personal relationship stuff is way more rewarding.
Yeah.
But when you talk about parent brands and the individual parent companies and the individual brands that they have, a lot of times they strive to have all of their baby brands beneath them look different and be different. So the perception by the marketplace is like, oh, that's different than that. But it's actually the same corporation that's responsible.
That's true. That is definitely a common approach. So that if there's any negative perception for this, this large company, you're not going to have that negative perception dribble down to the friendly ice cream company that you love, that is, you think your local company, which isn't.
Right.
Or your local your favorite beverage, but it's actually Pepsi.
right. And not that toxic brand.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So Laura, tell us about the long-term goals you have for your agency and for yourself personally, and make mention of what the name of your agency is and where people can find out more about you.
Thank you. So my company is Agency Bell with one L. I do have a website, www.agencybell.com. And I'm on LinkedIn. That's a great way to find me, Laura Souter. And then I do have a business page on LinkedIn as well as Facebook and Instagram. But in terms of the goals, I used to do a lot of public speaking, and I am interested to get back into that. I've started speaking at conferences. Obviously, you and I are on a podcast. I try to do a podcast a month. I just want to get back out there. And as I mentioned, I was a professor for 11 years. I've always been on boards of directors. So I just love helping, you know, supporting and helping and being a resource. Again, it's that guru part of me that just like feels like, you know, I've worked hard and I have a lot to share, and it's time to get back out there and share it.
Do you believe that the whole entire COVID experience has separated you from that high touch, very warm, soft and fuzzy world that we used to have?
Yes and no. I feel separated in general from a lot of things. But I was always virtual. Like I have worked for myself by myself with clients on, you know, multiple coasts, in different countries, and never met a lot of my clients, truthfully.
Right.
But I feel like even before COVID, I had that virtual softness, if you will. That being said, I just love people. I think that I have had to really reconvert myself to get back out there and have those in-person lunches, have those in-person networking moments, have those in-person meetings with clients, because it's so easy to just now click on a screen. And even if my client is in the next town over, not drive those 20 minutes and have that face-to-face. And I don't want to do it that way anymore.
Right, right. How do you respond to the people who you're sitting down at lunch with and they're inevitably holding this thing up and looking down at their screen instead of paying you the attention that you deserve?
I'm a little hardcore in that way. I have two kids and two stepkids, and we have a no phones at the dinner table policy when I ask them to keep the phones in their purses or whatever. Obviously, I'm not going to tell my client to do that or someone, you know, professional. But I think I have a little, again, it's that little boldness that comes with age of a little more directness and just saying, hey, you know, it's so precious to meet in person. Can we just be together for the next hour? Is that okay with you? You know, and try to avoid as many distractions as possible. You know, we both took the effort to come together today. I would feel comfortable saying that if possible.
Oh, that would be great. I'm working on trying to create a jammer so the person that I'm sitting across from in the restaurant cannot use their phone at all.
How does that work?
Well, you know, it's an electronics hack. You know, if a few kind words don't work, then maybe you can do something like that. It's experimental.
One of my kids gave me a little cell phone jail for Christmas this year because they know how hardcore I am about it. And so we don't use it, but it sits on the counter and threatens people.
That's a really cute idea. I love that. Yeah. That sounds marketable right away.
Yeah. It's a little plastic jail, and there's little slots in it so people can just slide in their cell phone and you put the door. It's very cute. It was such a little, you know, novelty gift, but they really know me because they know I am hardcore about it.
Right. Well, good for you for being hardcore, because there are way too many people who utilize devices and they give it to their kids as a babysitter so they don't have to be the parents.
I know. I mean, I was in, you know, these beautiful tours, and I understand kids of all ages can't focus forever, but kids are just on their iPads and just whatever, Candy Crush or whatever people do. And I'm like, look outside, look at this beautiful country that we're looking at, you know?
I know. It's like people do not train their children to learn and understand and drink it in and appreciate.
Right. And you even started the call by saying, let's just see what happens in between the little moments, like unscripted. What would happen if you just stared out the window of the train? What would you see? Maybe a whole lot of nothing, or maybe you'd see a castle or something amazing or a bunch of giant elephants. Who knows what you'd see? Just wait and wonder.
Right. You know, at the top of the conversation, you were talking about mindfulness, and a big part of mindfulness is attention and being able to focus on things that are happening in front of you, not things that are happening elsewhere on a third party screen.
Yeah, for sure. I love people watching. I find that so enjoyable without an agenda. Sometimes I'll even go early to a thing and just wait and see what happens. Maybe I'll make a new friend. Maybe I'll see something cool.
Right.
You know?
And people watching in Europe is just so special, isn't it? Because they have so many outdoor cafes and opportunities to do so. And there are millions of travelers.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great outfits, of course.
Where did you grow up and where are you now?
I grew up in Chicago, the best city in the world.
Does it also have the best pizza in the world?
Have been converted to flat. But yes, the deep dish is pretty special.
Uh-huh.
I live in Boston. I live in a town next to Boston, but literally I'm on the line. So I'm in suburban Boston, but on the cool end of town.
Do you ever whip out the old the cool Boston accent, like a wicked clam box or anything like that?
So I don't think I have an accent in general, but certain friends of mine will occasionally say I sound certain like home friends will say I sound a little Bostonian. I've been here 20 something years. I don't have a thick accent by any means. And I don't say wicked. I don't say any of those words.
Okay. That's funny because so many people who've been there have that real sound, you know, that built-in Boston sound.
I think you have to grow up here. I mean, like my kids, even though they grew up, because I don't talk like that. And I think kids that talk like that have parents who've been here multiple. Little twangy stuff sounds a little Bostonian every so often. I don't know what I say, but my New York City friends and my Chicago friends say sometimes, wow, that sounds really Boston.
So do you ever think about relocating to a city that would be more dreamlike and perfect for you, whether it's weather or lifestyle or the culture and society of a place that's somewhere else?
More and more so as my kids get older. I do want to move. I did not choose Boston. Boston chose my ex-husband, who, you know, I went here with. It's not the easiest place to live, truthfully. I mean, in terms of like the people aren't very, you know, warm, and I'm very warm. So I would like to move somewhere like Boulder, Colorado, or the West Coast, places where people are a little more open and accessible and friendly. I don't necessarily need like sunshine all the time. On the other hand, some nice weather would be nice. But I also like the seasons. I grew up with the seasons, too. But I think my fiance is from California. I think for us, we would feel very comfortable in California. He has family there, and I love California. So I think probably California would be my first choice.
What part of California?
Or Boulder. He's from San Luis Obispo on the Central Coast. And I think anywhere along the Central Coast would be nice. Obviously, Santa Barbara is amazing, but it's kind of too nice. I don't know.
Very expensive, but still nice and not an out of control city like a lot of the other cities. Like Los Angeles is having a very difficult time right now.
Oh, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a practical side of me, too, where I'm not going to just shell out $1 million for a shed. So, you know, I want nice, but like, you know, I'm practical, too.
Yeah, you want to be able to spread your wings for your $1 million.
Yeah, right?
Exactly. So. Okay, so what's next? Tell us before we say aloha.
I think what's next is I really am determined to enjoy my summer. My kids are home this summer. One's going to Columbia. The other one's going off to college. My oldest is going to Columbia grad school. My other one's going to college for the first time. And I'm really just trying to be like, this is like a really important summer. And I'm going to work hard, but I'm also going to relax and play hard and connect and be that mom for that last summer.
Well, that sounds good. Yeah. Summer can be so enjoyable.
Yeah.
Good. Good. Absolutely. I totally get behind that. So, Laura, once again, give us the name of your website and how people can find you. And then we'll say aloha.
Perfect. Better at Agency Bell 1L. And it's agencybell.com.
Nice. It reminds me of Baby Bell cheese.
Those aren't bad.
Well, thank you so much for coming aboard. It was really nice having you. I really appreciate speaking about all this great stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. And I love the questions.
Thanks, Laura. Take care and aloha.
I loved it. You're awesome. Aloha.